I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 139 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is one of rock's most distinct, energetic drummers and engaging personalities, Will Rigby of the DBs. The DBs were a great so-called power pop band of the early 1980s, a foursome of North Carolina natives who launched their collective career in New York and had their albums released in England. They were precursors of and friends with REM, but they had their own distinct, jaggedly tuneful sound. Singer-guitarists Chris Stamey and Peter Hulsapple, both previous Caro Pop guests, split the songwriting while the rhythm section of Rigby and bassist Gene Holder propelled the action. The band's landmark 1981 debut album, Stands for Decibels, is finally getting its first U.S. release on vinyl on Propeller Sound Recordings. Well, that took only 43 years, and it's streaming now as well. The excellent 1982 follow-up, Repercussion, will make its U.S. vinyl debut and start streaming sometime this fall. I bought the original Albion British imports of these albums because, yes, I was a DB's early adopter. The classic DB's lineup of those two albums also recently announced its first tour in 12 years, with dates in September and October on the East Coast and in the Midwest. Rigby recalls his early days working with Stamey in the band Sneakers and the formation of the DBs. What happened when the DBs, which had been led by Stamey, added another songwriter in Hulsapple? What was Rigby's impression of how Stamey's and Hulsapple's songs played off each other? And how did Rigby play those lightning-fast drum fills in Black and White and I'm in Love, both off the first album, and Ask for Jill off the second?
Hey, it's Chris. What's up?
Was Rigby surprised when Stamey left the band after Repercussion was finished? How did Rigby enjoy making the more American-sounding Like This, with Hulsapple as the sole singer-songwriter? How has Rigby's drumming for other artists, such as Steve Earle, differed from his work with the DBs? How is the new remaster of Stands for Decibels sourced? Rigby also discusses his own songwriting, which has resulted in two solo albums, Sidekick Phenomenon in 1985 and Paradoxaholic in 2002.
If I can be king, I will build my own hill, smack dab in the center of town.
He wrote the song Right Back on the 2012 DBs reunion album, Falling Off the Sky.
Right back.
Released a topical pissed-off single, Sin Corazon, in 2020. He explains the origins of that one. Rigby boasts lots of smarts, chops, and good humor, all of which come out whether he's performing or talking. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Will Rigby.
Cabeza naranja, manos pequeños, sin corazón.
So Stands for Decibels finally out in the US. That's kind of crazy. Like, how could this be the first US vinyl release of this? It seems nuts to me.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy that it didn't come out to begin with in the
right.
United States. It came out all over the world, but not US or Canada in 1981.
Yeah, I have that. I have the original copy of that. I have that. I think it's on Albion. And I have Repercussion, which was the copy Repercussion I have starts with Happenstance. A lot of them started with Living a Lie. So I don't know how that got all scrambled, but
the sequence that starts with Living a Lie is the sequence the band came up with. The other sequence is the record company's decision. We had nothing to do with.
I can't remember if it was like the German one was one way and the British one was another way, but it was something where it was kind of mixed up.
Well, as far as I know, there's only two sequences, and Albion came up with the other sequence. And when the German company Line bought out Albion sometime in the 80s, they kept the Albion sequence of that album, I believe.
Well, and when I bought Repercussion, it came with a cassette of the album too, and the cassette of the album had the ending part of I Feel Good on one side of the cassette and the rest of the song on the other side of the cassette. Like one, like they ended each side with part of I Feel Good instead of just having the song.
Yeah, they totally screwed up the cassette. And I believe that they screwed it up in more than one way. I think there's multiple different cassettes that have different mistakes on them, I believe, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I my copy of that had the I Feel Good split up.
It did strike me as weird, and I assume it struck you as weird too, that this was stuff that I kind of like, you know, my friends and I all really love the DBs, but a lot of people didn't know about them and the stuff wasn't available here, which on one hand made it kind of special, but on the other hand was like, what? Like, this is not uncommercial music. What did it feel like in the band to, you know, have the stuff out in England or Germany, but not have it out here?
Well, it kind of sucked, but, you know, it was better than not having it out at all. We would have preferred to be on an American record company, but we just weren't offered any deal that we were interested in. There was maybe some minor label that would have put it out, but it would have been with no promotion budget, and we just said no thanks.
So there was interest, but just not enough and not from the right people.
It was, if I remember correctly, which it's a long time ago, so it's hard to really remember for sure, but my memory is that the only label that expressed any interest was, and I'm not sure I'm saying it right, but JEM, J-E-M, which was basically the label of a distribution company. And they put out the first release of the third Big Star album in the United States.
Right.
Which, you know, is a very obscure release. And they weren't much of a record company, let's just put it that way. And I think they offered to put it out, but I'm not really positive of that. But no major label expressed any interest.
Had you recorded the whole album before you were shopping it around to labels?
The first album was recorded. We might have shopped it around before it was finished, but you know, we finished Black and White pretty early on in the process of recording that album and put it out as a 45. So we would have had at least that to shop around for quite a while. And, you know, as we recorded more, we probably played more for record companies.
And Alan Betrock, who was the editor, publisher of New York Rocker, was he, producing.
Yeah, he started New York Rocker, and he sold it out fairly quickly. By I think he started in 76 or 77, and by the time I arrived in New York in 78, it was already owned by somebody else. He'd already given it up.
My understanding of the DB's history, Chris Damey had recorded, you know, If and When, and done some stuff with Richard Lloyd. Then you and Gene Holder sort of joined together, and it became originally like Chris Damey and the DB's and the DB's. How did you all connect with each other?
Okay, so we all grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, kind of moved to New York one by one. Chris was first. He played with Alex Chilton for a year, that year being 1977. And then in 78, he was looking for something new to do and called me up and said, why don't you come up and play some gigs with me? And I was like kind of doing nothing in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And I certainly wasn't playing. And I was pretty into the New York scene as it was. So I was pretty ready to go. And same thing with Gene, who came from a different, I'm not even sure where Gene was living before he moved to New York, but I didn't particularly know Gene before we moved here anyway. So,
but you did know Chris.
I knew Chris from way back. Yeah.
Had you played with him before or just knew him?
Yeah. We had a band in Chapel Hill in 1976 called Sneakers that put out an EP.
Oh, right, right.
Before that, he was in, like, it gets too complicated to explain, but my high school band, basically, he was in just for the last few gigs. And so, yeah, we already knew each other. I didn't know Gene, but everybody else knew everybody else already. Like, Peter knew everybody. Gene knew, Chris knew all three of us. It's just Gene and I didn't know each other. June 1978 is when the DBs actually begin. First rehearsals, first gig was either June or early July. I can't remember.
And is that as a three-piece? Or is that with Peter in the band?
Just Peter joined in October 78. The DBs had played a handful of gigs, maybe as many as 10, but not that many gigs before Peter joined the group as a trio. We were sometimes joined by a keyboard player, Fran Kowalski, who had been in the Chilton band with Chris, and occasionally a sax player on a couple of songs, who was Gene's cousin, Bo Kalana. He played with us a few times, but not on every song, just on like one or two songs. So that was what Chris Stamey and the DBs was what it was originally called. And we recorded, that group recorded If and When and a couple of more songs that didn't come out until much later. He had already recorded I Thought You Wanted to Know with Richard Lloyd before I was around. So that recording was ready to go. And the other side of it was the first DB's recording, If and When.
Right. Okay. And then having Peter join the band, what was the creative dynamic like once you had two songwriters in there?
Well, originally, he was theoretically hired to be the organist.
Right.
And sort of we were kind of influenced by the Attractions. We just thought they were really, really hot band. And so we were kind of like trying to be like the Attractions a little bit. But Peter pretty much played guitar as well as organ from the get-go. It just depended on the song. He played a lot more organ at first, but the guitar was always there. And as time went on, we started doing Peter's songs, and you know, Peter played guitar on his songs, and it generally became a band of equals and two songwriters of equal stature fairly rapidly. I don't remember how long that took, but initially we just played Chris's songs, but we started playing Peter's songs pretty fast within a few months.
What did you think of how the two songwriters' songs sort of balanced each other out on those records and just in your sets?
I mean, in my opinion, they were very different, but obviously it's the same set of musicians playing them all. So that gave it some cohesion. I told Chris when he said, let's get Peter, I said, okay, I'm into it. Peter's like my big best friend, and I'm into it, but there's going to come a time when there's like too many songwriters, too many songs for one band. And, you know, sure enough, that happened within a few years. There were just too many songs.
Right. But so to go back to Stands for Decibels, did you go in with Alan Betrock and you're like, okay, this is the album, and it was sort of a certain number of weeks or days, or I don't know how long to make the record, and you know, you pretty much had figured out sort of what the songs were in the sequence? Or was it more kind of like you recorded a bit later, you recorded a bit more?
Yeah, we started that project as it was going to be Ork had a deal with British Warner Brothers. So it was going to be two 45s for Ork Warner UK, One was the DBs, and one was a Peter Holzapfel single. And that's how we started recording. We started with like four songs, which were going to be a DBs record with Chris songs and a Peter Holzapfel solo single with Peter songs. That's how that project got started. And that's the understanding under which Black and White was started, was it was going to be a Peter Holzapfel solo 45. And the Ork Warner UK deal quickly fell apart before we finished recording even those four songs. And so Alan said, let's make an album. And I'm going to find the investments, the money to record it. And that money came in slowly, and the recording did not take place at all at once. It was over a year spread out, just like whenever there was money to go into the studio, we would go in and record a little bit more. I don't remember how many times that happened, but four or five, I think, different periods during which we recorded, like a day or two at a time.
And when Alan said we're going to do it as an album, was the understanding like we're going to have Peter songs and Chris's songs and we're just going to mix them up?
No, at some point we just said we're the DBs and we're going to do Peter's songs as well as Chris's songs. And, you know, it started out as Chris Stamey and the DBs. We dropped the Chris Stamey and just became the DBs, started doing both songwriters' songs. And from that point on, it was pretty much equal distribution of songwriting time between the two of them.
So with a Chris song like Cycles Per Second, there's a really intricate drum part that you're playing on that. Did Chris come in with the idea for that, or did you come up with that? Like, how did the song sort of evolve from Chris bringing it into the band performing it?
In the very early days, there was a few songs that Chris came up with the drum pattern for, one of which I can say for sure was Ask for Jill, which is on Repercussion.
Right. Which has a lot of great fills on it, by the way.
Thank you. Chris came up with the pattern for that song. I don't remember exactly how we came up with the drum part for Cycles Per Second. I mean, Chris wouldn't have been able to show me that.
Right.
I probably came up with myself. He may have said, like, play a pattern on the snare drum without the hat. He might have said something like that. I can't really recall exactly how that came about.
And then Dynamite is one that's credited to all four of you. Do you remember how that one came together?
Yeah. It's questionable whether Gene and I had really anything to do with the composition of that song. But Peter and Chris were just messing around. Like, after rehearsal, Gene and I had left, and I believe Peter was just messing around on the drums. And anyway, he and Chris just started playing something, and it just popped out of their brains as sort of fully formed as Dynamite. I think I wasn't there, but, you know, when it came to me and Gene, it was pretty much a finished product. I don't know why. I don't really remember why they like credited all four members, but it was definitely like Chris and Peter made that up together.
Do you remember just sort of when, you know, when either one of them would bring in songs thinking, oh, that's a really good one, or, you know, oh, I'm not sure about that one. But like, would you get excited about like the songs they were bringing in?
Yeah, we pretty much like tried anything and everything in the early days. It was like nothing was like off the table. And if they had a song, we'd try to work it up. And sometimes we would come up with something and sometimes we wouldn't. But there's a lot of songs left behind that never got recorded of both Chris and Peter's songs, which we might have played live a few times. I can remember one of Chris's that we played live a lot that never got recorded. It, to me, is like the great lost DBU song.
What is it?
Well, it had a few names. The chorus was "You're Gonna Want Me To." Overwhelmed, I think, was the last title it had. It was sort of a disco, a rock disco type of track with like a four on the floor bass drum. But yeah, that one, love to find like a good record, live recording of it. It was a really good song.
You never tried to bring it back on any of the reunion tours or anything? You could work it up now.
No, like I think Chris lost interest in it. He was, you know, he was writing songs at a furious pace.
Right.
And he lost interest in songs pretty quickly, especially early on.
I've talked to Chris and Peter for this podcast and really enjoyed talking to both of them. And I definitely got a sense of sort of contrast in that I felt like Chris was not that keen on sort of living in the past or revisiting the past and wanted to always be sort of pushing forward. And you know, whereas Peter, who also obviously is still working and performing and everything, also, you know, liked reflecting on, you know, this is what we'd done and that sort of thing. But it seemed like there was a bit of a contrast there. Do you see that?
Well, yeah, they're very, very different people and different, you know, the way their brains work is very different. I could certainly see that being the case about Chris not really being that interested in rehashing the past. I would say that I don't know how excited about that Peter would be, but he's more liable to indulge in that sort of thing. It's kind of fun to try to remember. I can't remember everything that you're asking me even, but it's fun to try.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, the new sponsor of the Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago. Congratulations, Revolution! Revolution is Illinois' largest independent brewery and the maker of, among other great beers, the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. On these scorching summer days, Cold Time really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. When you were deciding to be a drummer, sort of what was it that attracted you to drums? And were there drummers that you were sort of looking at, like, I want to have that kind of function in a band?
Well, it's very cliched for people in my generation to say it was the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And, you know, most people wanted to be John or Paul, but I wanted to be Ringo. I will say that, like, on the Ed Sullivan show, Ringo was way up in the air. He was very, very visible, which is not really been my experience as a drummer.
You didn't tell them to, like, give me one of those Ed Sullivan risers.
No, that doesn't really exist. Except on TV.
In 1964.
But anyway, so yeah, ever since seeing that, I wanted to be a drummer. And I got a snare drum in the fifth grade. So I was like not quite eight when the Beatles came on. And I got a snare drum in the fifth grade. So that's when I'm 11, I think. And a drum set when I was 14.
And would you and just,
I was able to play by the time I was 16, I would say.
Would you play along with records or how did you practice?
Yeah, I did a lot of that at first, although it was hard to hear them. I had a set of headphones that I'd play along with records, but it was still hard to hear that music on the headphones over the drums themselves.
And you talked about the DBs liking the attractions. Did you like Pete Thomas in particular?
Yeah, they were all super musicians. I mean, Steve Naive is just incredible. But, you know, the Bruce and Pete Thomas were just both super awesome musicians. We just thought the world of them as musicians.
On Stands for Decibels and Repercussion, you know, it's what, like 81, 82 when those are coming out. Yeah, there are a lot of, like, you know, fast tempos on them. Were you as the drummer kind of pushing the tempo, or would the whole band be like, yeah, this is how fast the song should be?
Well, I'm tempted to say maybe it was the drugs, but I mean, we weren't on drugs all the time or anything, but you know, when you're young, you just naturally kind of like have that get up and go. You know, I don't think I could play Black and White at the tempo it is on the record in this day and age. I don't know if I'm capable of playing it that fast. I'll play it as fast as I can, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, like Neverland's a fast one. Like you mentioned Ask for Jill.
I'm in Love is also a really fast one.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, that too. And Black and White, as you mentioned.
Black and White was sped up. That one is... the recording is slightly sped up from the tempo we played it at, but it was plenty fast the way we record it. But that one is like goosed a little bit.
Yeah. You got a bunch of those rat-a-tat fills in that one as well. And then I thought you wanted to know there's a Don Dixon mix of that. And I just had Don Dixon on a couple weeks ago, but how was he involved with you guys?
Well, he was kind of like older brother. In like 76, when Chris and I were living in Chapel Hill and had that band Sneakers, he was like in the band that was sort of established around town, Arrogance. And he was like super enthusiastic about the Sneakers and actually wound up engineering the Sneakers recording and sort of producing it. I'd say more or less producing it, although, you know, a lot of the ideas were Chris's.
And Mitch Easter was in that band too, right?
Yeah. It started out without Mitch. It started out as this four-piece. The other guitar player was Rob Slater. And we got a gig at Max's Kansas City, which we basically rehearsed all summer for, and for this one gig. I mean, we couldn't get gigs in North Carolina. Nobody wanted us. And so we just did a lot of rehearsing. That band rehearsed a lot and played almost zero gigs. I mean, I think we played like five gigs in 1976. And once we got the gig at Max's Kansas City, we kind of like... mutual interest in Mitch joining. He was interested in participating, and we were interested in having him. So he joined sort of after the recording was done. Although he played acoustic guitar on the first Sneakers record, but that's all like Chris Stamey songs. I wrote the lyrics to one of them, but those are Chris Stamey songs. Mitch was there, but he was just like playing acoustic to fill out the sound. And so then when we got this one real gig, then Mitch joined and we were playing Chris and Mitch's songs.
Got it. So Mitch and Don Dixon were working together back then to some extent.
Well, that was before Mitch and Don were really involved with each other. Mitch was still in college then. So he wasn't doing a whole hell of a lot, but he was recording. But a lot of what Mitch did back then was just record by himself because he could play every instrument. And right. he made tons of recordings that way, even going back to high school. But the way that Don wound up mixing some of Stands for Decibels was... Mitch had like started his recording studio outside of Winston-Salem, which was called Drive-In, literally in his parents' garage. And Don was there pretty much like from the get-go, like helping Mitch set it up and just hashing through ideas. for how it would work. And so some of Stands for Decibels was mixed at the drive-in studio, which was super early on for the drive-in studio. This is
right.
Quite a ways before REM went there and recorded their first single. And I think it was before any record that had been made at drive-in studio came out. I can't remember when the first one was. I think it was some of the first stuff that was done at drive-in studio was mixing. I think it was about half of Stands for Decibels. I can't really remember which songs were mixed there.
Right. And that one mix that's
Black and White that was put out was mixed at the studio where we recorded at Blue Rock in Manhattan.
Right. Because the Don Dixon mix of that was on the I Thought You Wanted to Know compilation, but that's not the one that was on Stands for Decibels.
Right. That was one that Don just said, I'm going to do this. We didn't ask him or the tapes were there and he just ran off a mix really fast. That's how that came about. But he did actually mix some of the songs on Stands for Decibels, but I can't remember which ones.
Okay. And then Scott Litt produced Repercussion. What was that recording and, you know, that whole experience like compared to the first one?
Well, it was all done at once, more or less, which was, that was pretty different. We had a real recording budget. That was really different. We had a real producer. That was really different. We went to London to do it. And that was really, really different. So it was very, very different. And, you know, it was recorded all at once. And I'd like to think it has a more cohesive sound for that reason.
Was it a smooth process?
It was smooth in the sense that it went all the way through from beginning to end all at once. It was fraught in other ways. I would say there was some emotional difficulties involved at the time, but I don't really want to necessarily get into that, but it was fairly emotional time.
Yeah, I mean, my impression from talking to Chris and Peter was that maybe there was there's more sort of producer impact in that. And I think Chris maybe felt like he wasn't having as much, you know, as he wanted to, or, you know, as much say on some of the stuff, but.
Yeah, that could be. But I mean, it was any of the band's first experience with having a producer. And it was Scott's first experience as of being a producer of a record. He had co-producing credit prior to that, but it was the first record that he produced on his own. So it was kind of a learning experience all around.
You guys had
and it was intense in that we were uprooted and moved to London. The record company insisted that we do it there. And so we're all living together as well as working together. I guess that's probably where the emotions come in, because, you know, when you live together and work together, there's going to be some spats.
It's not as harmonious as you see in Help.
Yeah. Those Beatles, they seem to get along pretty good, don't they?
They seem to for a bit. They didn't last that much longer, but.
Right. But even in that movie that came out a couple of years ago, what was it called? Get Back?
Get Back. Yeah, the documentary.
Like, even though they're kind of quarreling with each other, they're also really getting along pretty well, it seems like to me, for the most part.
Yeah, given the reputation those sessions have and, you know, where they were in their lives and everything, you're like, nah, they're still making some pretty great music.
It was a very intense experience living and working together in a foreign land. It was a really intense time to be in London, because not only were there riots going on, there was like the royal wedding happened while we were there.
Oh yeah.
It was really, really intense time in London, in all of England really, but especially in London.
Were you surprised at the end of that album experience that Chris left the band?
Surprised? Not really. There was, you know, there was too many songs for one band. And, you know, Chris had a band's worth of songs and Peter had a band's worth of songs. And, I mean, there was other considerations in him leaving the band. You know, there was the usual interpersonal tensions and stuff like that. I would say it was not a huge surprise. It wasn't really what the rest of us wanted, but it was probably for the best for all concerned.
Was there ever any hesitation about just continuing on as the DBs after he left?
It was kind of dicey there because we didn't play any gigs without Chris for quite a while, 2 years. There was no DB's gigs as a trio ever with just Peter and Gene and Will. Not that I recall. There might have been like one for fun show, but we basically just did a lot of demoing and tried to get signed. And, you know, if we hadn't gotten signed, we probably would have, that would have been the end.
But you got signed with Bearsville. So
we signed to Bearsville. We had tons and tons of demos, tons of songs, but it took a while. I mean, so Chris left in spring of 82. We started recording like this in fall of 83. And in between, all that really happened was making a bunch of demos and doing a bunch of rehearsing. It was kind of theoretical whether there was really a DBs at that point until Bearsville signed us. And then once Bearsville signed us, then it was always going to really happen.
What do you think of the songs that Peter was bringing in?
He had a lot of great ones. Love Is for Lovers and Lonely Is, just a great, great song. He had so many. We started at least four other songs at Bearsville that didn't get finished. It might have been more than that. It was at least four songs that didn't make the cut.
You got a lead vocal on White Train on that one. You close the album out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Forgot about that. It's been a long time.
It's definitely a more American sounding record than Repercussion, which somehow, having been recorded in London, maybe sounds more like it's a British influenced band. And, you know, like this sounds like it's an album recorded in the US. Guitars are a little louder.
I especially was pretty into country music at that point. And it rubbed off on Peter a little bit to like, there's a couple of songs on that that are sort of country influenced. Not all of it, but
even some like New Gun in Town, like it's not like a country song, but it's got some twang going on a little bit.
Yeah. That song to me is kind of like the, it's a bit of an albatross. I think that song, that's just my opinion. It's way too hard rock for my taste these days.
When you made that album, did you think, oh, you know, were you someone who sort of thought about the commercial prospects of records? Like, oh, you know, Love Is for Lovers, Spy in the House of Love. These are hit records.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the very beginning, we wanted to have hits. We weren't particularly interested in compromising our ambition to make creative records just to have a hit. But we, you know, it would have been great if Black and White was a huge hit. It would have been great if Neverland or whatever song on Repercussion was a big hit. It would have been great if Love Is for Lovers was a huge hit. I would say after Chris quit, then the next two albums, that Peter wrote all the songs for were a little more, I think we're a little more aware of trying to make commercial records. That's only relative to like the first two albums, which are pretty uncompromising, I think. But yeah, like Spy in the House of Love is a good example because to me, that just sounds like a hit. And
I thought so. Still do.
You know, we were trying to make a hit. That's still really good, but, you know, we were also trying to make a hit.
Yeah, in Chicago, WXRT was playing that and Love is for Lovers, and maybe that's one of the reasons you have such a good following here when the DBs do shows here, because we did actually hear them here, and they sounded great on the radio. I didn't understand why I wouldn't hear them everywhere.
Well, our experience was wherever we got played on the radio, we were popular, and that wasn't everywhere, and you could really tell a difference when we went to Chicago or DC or Atlanta, anywhere that we got played on the radio, we had a following. The towns in between were a little more challenging.
Peter said that there was a different mix. There was an earlier mix of Like This that had come out or that didn't come out, but that I don't know if whether Albert Grossman or whoever, you know, wanted it remixed, but there was another version of that record. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, okay. So the album is produced by Chris Butler, and he went all the way from rehearsals with us. He did like a lot of woodshedding of the songs in rehearsals before we started recording. Recorded the record, and Chris mixed it, and Bearsville rejected the Chris Butler mixes, and Gene wound up mixing it with the engineer there, Mark McKenna.
How much of a difference was there in the sound of them?
There was a little bit less reverb on Gene's version than Chris Butler's mixes. I remember them being pretty reverb heavily. I remember liking the Chris Butler mix of White Train a lot. But I haven't heard those in years, so who knows?
Does this exist somewhere?
It does, but where would be? That would be a good question. The DBs have reclaimed the rights to that album, not to the others, but to that album. We have reclaimed the rights to the recordings. I don't think we have the actual tapes, but I think they might have been located.
That'd be cool.
One thing that is worth noting about the DBs is we don't have any of our tapes. We don't have any of them. And we don't really know where they are.
So what was the sourcing on the new version of Stands for Decibels?
The remaster is from the previous CD, the IRS CDs of Stands for Decibels and Repercussion, which came out in 1989, are the source of remastering. And those, I think, were mastered for CD from the original mixes, if I remember correctly.
Right.
But in terms of getting like the 2-inch master tapes, the multi-track tapes, we don't know where they are. We'd love to get hold of them and remaster from the original tapes, but we don't possess them.
Hmm. And no idea where they are, if they're just like in someone's basement or if
I wouldn't say we don't have any idea where they are. They're probably in Germany, but the German company Line Records bought out Albion pretty much, as far as I understand, lock, stock and barrel. Just like Albion sold them everything, including the tapes. That's my understanding. So we think and hope that the masters of the first two albums are in Germany, but we don't have them. And the guy that runs that company is really old, and it's kind of a one-man shop, I think.
Hmm. So Like This came out in 84. I saw you play at the Peppermint Lounge the summer of 85, where I had I had an internship, and I dragged a whole bunch of friends there, and it was really late show, and they're like, we got to get up tomorrow. And I'm like, the DVDs haven't come on. So I waited. And it was pretty fantastic.
The shows used to be so late in New York.
It was like 2 or something like that. It was really late.
That was the way it was back then. Like the Peppermint Lounge and Danceteria, they all just had the bands went on so late. It's just ridiculous to think of now.
Yeah, no, and it was a work night too, but I was like, it's the DBs. I have to see them, because I'd seen you open at a bigger theater, but I hadn't seen like the straight set. So, and then around that time you started songwriting, right? Like Psychic Phenomenon was 85.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. So that did come out in 1985. Made up of like the very first demos I ever made or came out as an album. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. There's some good songs on it, but
I remember The Question from back then and a bunch of the other ones. My friend who got me to the DBs, we listened to it. We enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, I think there's 2 songs of mine on that record that are absolutely good songs, Hearts Expired and Tale of a Star. I think Tale of a Star is a really good song, but anyway, those were the very first recordings I ever made by myself. And, Irene Georgia Viola Tango put that out right around the time the first Yola Tango record came out, in fact. It was pretty close to the same time.
And then Paradoxaholic was 2002, and that was a more intentional album.
That was recorded as an album, but also in fits and starts, and in the mid and late 90s was most of the recording of that album. But that was more like I'm playing with a band, whereas the first album is just me just tinkering around by myself mostly.
How much of, you know, being in the DBs and seeing Chris and Peter work informed how you were writing songs?
I don't know if I'm really have the, what do you call it, critical distance to answer that question. I certainly am influenced by the same influences that Peter Holzapfel in particular was influenced by. He was a big influence on me just in terms of like learning about music. Peter like bought the first Richard Thompson album when it came out and stuff like that. He was just really, really interested in a whole lot of things that I wouldn't have known about without him. But in terms of my songwriting, I don't really think it bears much of a resemblance, certainly to Chris Stamey's songs. But I mean, if you heard what I'm doing now.
I heard Sin Corazon, which was the last one.
Yeah, my stuff's pretty weird. it's not like, I don't think I'm really capable of writing like just a regular old song. There's always some kind of twist to it.
You got a good sense of humor, so that's appreciated.
Yeah.
Right Back is a fun song on Falling Off the Sky, the 2012.
Right, but not a funny song. That one is not a funny song.
No, although the wordplay in it it's a serious song with some playful, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely wordplay in it, but the reason I called the album Paradoxaholic was I was trying to find a word to describe the fact that I had these funny songs and I had these broken heart songs, and there was like kind of nothing in between that was like sort of more normal, or anyway, there was these two polar opposite type of songs that I was coming up with, and I couldn't really, to me, they didn't really go together.
Right.
But that's what I have and had. And so I just was trying to come up with a word that described that spread, you know, the just two opposite ends of the spectrum. And that was just the word that I came up with trying to describe that.
Well, and Sin Corazon was you pissed off at how the pandemic was being handled, you know, under the president at the time.
I was pissed off at Donald Trump. But it was during the pandemic. So I have like some newer stuff that I hope to have come out at some point.
Do you still write regularly or semi-regularly? Or
I wouldn't say I write a lot of songs. No. I start a lot more than I finish. Let's put it that way.
Join the club.
I start a number of songs, a good number of songs, and I finish some of them. And I record an even lower number of them. But lately, I've been a little better. In the last year or two, I've been doing a little better and getting stuff recorded. So I have a few tracks that are in varying stages of completion.
What have the sort of the intermittent DB's reunions been like for you? Is like, are they happy, you know, everyone getting together kind of affairs?
We have 3 weekends of shows booked so as of now, and there'll probably be more, but at the moment, the attitude is let's see how these go. And not because of any like tension within the band, but more in terms of like how well we draw and stuff like that.
When you do these reunion shows, do you practice a lot, or are you able to just kind of pick it up quickly? And
we're going to rehearse as much as we can. We need it. I mean, we're pretty rusty. We haven't played at all in 6 or 8 years. And when we did, it was just a handful of songs. That was like a benefit, or maybe two. I think we played 2 benefit shows in like 2016. But that was just like 5 songs or something like that. And it was a very short show. The last time we did real serious gigs was in 2012.
Would you consider doing another DB's album?
I'd say it's unlikely, but I wouldn't be too surprised if we record something. We have a lot of leftover tracks from Falling Off the Sky. We recorded way more than we could put out on that album. Not all of them are finished.
You had that album, and then you had the EP the year later that also had really good songs on it.
Right. Well, a couple of them wound up coming out on Chris Stamey Records. We have a sort of newly recorded version of a song that dates from Repercussion era that didn't get recorded for Repercussion, but it was already a song and had been demoed in time for it to be on Repercussion, but it just didn't make the cut. That song is called Depth of Field.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's on Chris Samey's first solo album. And but there was a DB's version back in like the era of Repercussion, and there's a sort of newly recorded over the course of the last 8 or 10 years, maybe less, maybe more like 6, version of Depth of Field that has kind of only recently been completed. And we kind of batted around the idea of doing something with it for this upcoming re-release of Repercussion, but decided against it. It sounds really, really different. But I mean, the song dates from back then.
Right. Yeah, and I know they covered it they did a version of it on Our Back Pages, the acoustic record that Peter and Chris did that came out on Record Store Day several years ago.
And there was the version of the Kink song "I'm on an Island" that came out on a benefit album a couple of years ago during the pandemic. It was like a pandemic relief record, which is on Bandcamp only. It's an album called Cover Charge. So there's that, and there's actually a DB's recording of Waterloo Sunset that has yet to see the light of day.
When is that from?
Well, I moved here in 2010, and it was since then. So probably a little newer than Falling Off the Sky. It's not real new.
Right. You've drummed with other bands and artists as well, like Steve Earle or Matthew Sweet. Like when you're drumming with other bands, like how much of an adjustment is it when you go from band to band? Like, do you change your style? You know, if you're playing with Steve Earle as opposed to playing with the DBs, I mean, obviously they're different songs.
Yeah, those two are real, real different. Steve Earle likes it super simple and straight ahead. So that's what I do. That's what I did when I was playing with Steve Earle. Was there's not a whole lot of filigree, you know, drum fills. It was really kept it pretty simple in Steve Earle's band. When I was playing with Matthew Sweet, he pretty much let me do whatever I want. So I would say that was like more similar to what I did in the DBs, which is, you know, in the DBs, I just do whatever I want. I mean, sometimes like Chris or Peter will have an idea of what they want, but usually it's pretty obvious what to do. But I would say in general, I just try to play. If I have a strength, it's like thinking like the songwriter and what would the songwriter want, and trying to play the drums that way. I really try to play the song as opposed to trying to get my rocks off or whatever.
Right. Do you play a lot now?
It's getting better. Like during the pandemic, no. but it's getting better. I'm a little more busy this year than I have been in the past few years. There was pretty much nothing during the pandemic. I have played a fair amount in the last year and a half, 2 years with my wife, Florence Dorr, who had an album out also on Propeller Sound Recordings. And I'm on that. And we did some touring in the fall of 22 and the spring of 23. And the rest of like 23, I pretty much didn't play. And now I'm doing Sneakers gigs, DB's gigs coming up. Peter and I had a high school band that did a reunion show in April that we rehearsed a lot for. We needed it because we hadn't played in years and years. But so I'm kind of like doing all these oldies acts type of things this year, but you know, playing a fair amount now.
What are the Sneakers gigs?
Played a handful of shows in January that were on the East Coast, which were in combination with this group, the Salt Collective, which they put out an album on Propeller Sound also. It's a French guy and his band, and a bunch of like Americans played on the record. Chris Stamey, I played on it. In fact, all the DBs are on that record, not all at the same time, but Matthew Cause from Natty Surf is on it. Matthew Sweet sang a song. Juliana Hatfield sang a song. It's kind of a super group type of situation where the French guy wrote all the songs, but he wrote all the music, and like these American artists did the wrote the lyrics and sang them.
Got it.
So that project did a bunch of shows in January, and Sneakers opened for that. And now we're playing, in June, we're playing Winston-Salem, Athens, and Charlotte. And that's all that's going on right now with Sneakers. But there might be more coming up. Who knows?
So you got a busy year going on.
Yeah, compared to during the pandemic, which was not busy at all.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
That's it for episode 139 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Will Rigby for taking us through his work with the DBs and beyond. Go to thedbs.com, no apostrophe, to order the Stands for Decibels remaster and associated merch. You also can get info about and buy tickets for the DBs' September and October live dates that have been announced so far, including shows in North Carolina, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New Jersey, St. Paul, Minnesota, and at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music. Look for the Repercussion remaster to come out sometime this fall as well. You also can order Will Rigby music, including his album Paradoxaholic, at willrigby.bandcamp.com. Oh, and go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or caropop.com to hear the previous episodes in which Chris Stamey and Peter Holsapple recall the making of those DBs albums. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake. Hey, it's Chris. What's up? So I heard. For a mere $24, you can become a Caropop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at caropop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at caropopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.